It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead of daylight saving time, we explore the value of a quality night's rest on our body in the latest research. Health groups like the American Academy of Sleep Medicine have called for an end to the seasonal shifting of clocks. Call in with your questions and tips about catching Z's. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Alexander Villarreal is medical director of the La Crosse-based Sleep Center at Gundersen Health System. Dr. Villarreal, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. So how does the spring forward time change affect our sleep?
Oh, that is an excellent question. The main thing is by doing that, it deprives ourselves from sleep. So the average person gets 40 minutes of less sleep. And although it might not sound as much, as a society, we're chronically sleep deprived. So that increases impairment for sleep. Additionally, it does change somewhat our body clock. And some people are forced to get up and function at a time when they feel the drowsiest.
How long does it take generally to readjust our internal clocks after a time shift, a time change?
Well, I said if we plan ahead of time, work over the weekend, we might be able to do this over 2 or 3 days to adjust for that full hour of change. So just trying to shift backwards by 15 or 20 minutes, 2 or 3 days ahead of time can help.
Can you explain a little bit how sunrise and sunset affects our sleeping and waking habits and our internal clocks?
Yes, absolutely. So we all have a internal body clock in our brain, and that is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. But then that adjusts and synchronizes you with your environment thanks to the light that you get. And this light, as it hits your eyes, and that sends that signal, does it, to your brain, which in turn, as it will suppress, you know, melatonin, which is sort of like your night, sleeping hormone. And this, as it activates, as it your body clock, and tells your brain when it's supposed to be awake. This is why, as it, if you were to travel to another time zone, let's say you went to Europe or went to the West Coast, eventually you adapt to that new time zone if you get exposed, as it, to light and keep that normal routine.
How does sleep deprivation affect a person's day-to-day behavior? What do you see in the research and in your patients?
Sleep deprivation has several, as it said, negative effects. First, as it is by increasing, as it sleepiness, it affects concentration, so you're not able to function and work at your highest level. Secondly, it affects areas of your brain that are related to memory, so you might not be able to recall and remember things very well. It does also act, as it, your frontal lobe, so therefore you are more impulsive and might be more rash with your decisions. Maybe speed through that yellow light instead of taking a pause. And it also has some hormonal asset properties. So it can affect areas of your metabolism by suppressing leptin, increasing ghrelin, and this in turn will increase your appetite and cravings for carbs. And this in turn can cause more weight gain. So a lot of people think that if they have sugar, they're going to help with their sleepiness, but it is because they're sleepy and sleep deprived that they crave those carbs.
Can stress or anxiety or depression also affect, sleep problems?
Most definitely. As it, the relationship between mood and sleep is extremely closed. If your mood is not right, if you are worried about something or feeling down and blue, you will not be able to sleep well. And at the same token, if you don't sleep very well, as if that is going to affect your mood and make things worse for you. So it has a bi-directional relationship. And it's very important when treating a person with mood problems, anxiety, depression, and sleep issues to treat both to obtain optimal outcomes.
We're learning about sleep habits ahead of the springtime change. We have Dr. Alexander Villarreal, Medical Director of the Sleep Center at Gunderson Health System. You can join in with your questions, your comments about sleep, 800-642-1234. Dr. Villarreal, you mentioned the weekend ahead of the time change, or in the days ahead of the time change. How should people adjust their sleep schedules before, you know, before adjusting the clocks?
Well, a practical approach is it would be to start that Friday night, if you could attempt to go to bed 20 minutes earlier, and then 20 minutes earlier that Saturday night, and then Sunday night, another 20 minutes. So within 3 days, you can get used to that new system, and also make sure that your get-up time is also shifted by 20 minutes. And that can help us quite a bit. Additionally, making sure that you avoid alcohol close to bedtime or caffeine close to bedtime will be quite helpful. And regular physical activity will also help quite a bit.
You don't mention being disciplined about this. I mean, we really have to pay attention to this, and we have to exercise. In order to have good sleep hygiene, you have to be disciplined about it.
Well, I think the way I see this, that discipline is important, but also try to listen to your body, listen to how you feel. So if you get a better night's sleep, most people can feel much more rested. They can feel happier. They can feel much better in every single way. So if you seek that as an incentive, if you have to feel that way, then just to listen to your body and get some additional sleep. That'll help you feel a lot better. You can give it a try.
The studies also say that our teenagers are losing sleep, an average of 32 minutes of sleep per night, according to one study. How can parents and caregivers help the youth adjust better?
Well, that is a tough question to have your teenager do what you want them to do. But I think open and honest communication is very helpful, pointing us towards open discussions, where to get credible information about this. I think the National Sleep Foundation has some excellent information for sleep and teens, and showing us some of the benefits of getting that additional sleep. So better academic performance, safer drivers. A lot of teenagers get into car accidents early in the morning, 7, 8 o'clock, because they're prone to sleeping. You know, they tend to be owls. And if on top of that they're sleep deprived, they can have more issues and less experience driving. It's just the perfect storm for increased car accidents in the morning. And to let them know that they can be safer, they can function better. There's even studies that show that if you get enough sleep, you look better. So there you go. I said, hopefully that's something that helps some of our teenagers.
What about people who work shifts and who work overnight shifts in particular? What is your advice to them?
So that is a very, very a tough one. Here, again, there's a lot more, and that goes to just some generic advice, because circumstances can vary a lot. Are we talking of a young single person without any other responsibilities? Are we talking of a person who is a caregiver of two or more people that has a partner, or someone without a partner? There can be many things, but as I said, two practical things would be attempting to prioritize getting enough sleep. So 7 to 8 hours over a 24-hour period would be best. Oftentimes, if they have a larger chunk amount of sleep on a regular schedule, would be best. But if they can't, sometimes look forward to what's called an anchor sleep. So getting a long nap about an hour before their shift, you know, usually 2-3 hours, can help them function better. And for those who have a swing shift, so those who vary quickly between night shift and day shifts, so here I'm talking about people like railroad workers, police officers, healthcare workers, that really becomes really tricky. I think a lot of companies and have been much more aware of this, and they're trying to leave enough time for people to adapt their new schedules, leaving them for breaks in between changes in their schedules and moving things forward because it's easier to stay up late as opposed to trying to go to bed earlier.
Dr. Alexander Villarreal, a sleep medicine specialist at Gundersen Health System, calling with questions about sleep, studies you've wondered about, what you do to get a good night's rest. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. On Sunday, we set our clocks forward 1 hour, and that means letting go of that precious hour of sleep over the weekend. This is lawmakers on Capitol Hill pushed to make daylight saving time permanent. We examine the latest medical research on sleep with your questions and tips along the way. 800-642-1234. Dr. Alexander Villarreal is a sleep medicine specialist with Gundersen Health System. Let's bring in Jerry in Appleton. Jerry, hi, what's on your mind? Oh, I'm sorry, Jerry is not there. Let's go to Rebecca in Milwaukee. Rebecca, what is your question?
Hi, I'm interested in knowing the connection between daylight savings time and people with mental health issues like depression or anxiety.
Thank you, Rebecca. Dr. Villarreal, can you make some connections there?
Yes. So again, we mentioned there's a very close relationship between sleep and mood. So changes, is it in sleep, especially sleep duration, can result in greater set of problems. So if a person, for example, has bipolar disease, getting less sleep can impact their mood and sometimes, in more severe cases, lead to more manic episodes. Some people who might suffer from anxiety may be very concerned about having to get up earlier for work or being late, and that can also lead to exacerbations of that problem and worsening insomnia. So there is a very close connection, and that's why sometimes an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of treatment. So just looking at how to correct things gradually and easily, getting ready for that daylight savings just over the weekend can help prevent a lot of headaches.
What are some important lab tests for you for evaluating sleep problems?
So something that'll be surprising to a lot of people is we don't need too many lab tests to diagnose a lot of sleep problems. Example, if we are suspecting of insomnia, this is a clinical diagnosis just by talking. So the insomnia is having trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, waking up too early, despite having the chance and the opportunity to do so is something that we can diagnose by talking. Having issues with sleep deprivation is again something we can discuss as it by talking, and restless leg syndrome is another thing we can also discuss just by talking and making a diagnosis this way. Some conditions require some additional treatment. So currently, a lot of people who have obstructive sleep apnea, this is a problem caused by the airway closing up repeatedly during their sleep. It's almost like being smothered every few minutes. This is something that we will need a test to confirm this. And most adults can have a home sleep apnea test, which tends to be easier, quicker, and less expensive than a traditional sleep study. And then I said, for a lot of people, we might also need a traditional sleep study, which involves going to a sleep center that has a bedroom-like environment where you would go there and spend the night. A trained technologist would place some little sensors that look like little golden buttons using a spatial paste or glue on your head, face, neck, chest, legs. And they'd also take a look at your breathing and brain waves. So with all this, I said the purpose of this is to find out what the changes are occurring as in your body while you're sleeping, not so much to see how well you sleep. And this can be very helpful to find out more complex types of sleep apneas, seizures during sleep, Parasomnias, these are people who do like violent behaviors while they're sleeping. We might also look into narcolepsy, people who are excessively sleepy that is not explained by their medications or their schedules.
I want to stop you
So
right there. What are more complex types of sleep apnea? What do you mean by that?
yeah, so let's start here with the basics. So sleep apnea, I think the easiest definition for people to understand would be problems breathing during sleep. That's all. The most common type is the one we call obstructive sleep apnea or OSA. And this one tends to be caused, as it, by the airway closing up repeatedly during sleep. This blockage happens usually behind the tongue or behind the uvula. OSA tends to happen a lot more as people gain weight, so obesity tends to be very closely linked to it. Age and male gender. There's also other things too there. And the reason I said weight gain is something that's so closely connected is because when people gain weight, it's not only girth around their waistline, but also their neck gets thicker, and inside the opening of the airway gets much smaller. I invite us at any of the listeners to their access to a computer or their phone to Google as it OSA, airway and weight loss, and they can go to the images and they can link them to the studies, and they'll be able to see how that direct correlation between that. Then I said that as we get older, our tissues get a little bit floppier. So it's that they lose that consistency, so they can close up easily and easier as we're sleeping. And the global trends of population are that as a nation, as a world, we are getting older and heavier, and that is increasing, as I said, the prevalence of health problems related to weight and age, such as obstructive sleep apnea, diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease.
Dr. Villarreal of Gundersen Health System, sleep specialist. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Appleton. Jerry, what would you like to bring up?
Yeah, thank you very much. Good morning, Kate and Dr. Villarreal. I want to bring up a factoid that you're not old enough to remember, but I remember extremely well. I was in high school, and during the energy crisis, the Arab oil embargo in 1973, Congress passed a law that the entire continental U.S. would stay on daylight savings time year-round, which is now what's being proposed. But what actually happened, it went into effect in January 1974. What actually happened was people hated it so much that it was rescinded before the two-year trial period ended. It was rescinded after 1 year. And the reason is, I remember I was in high school, I had chemistry class first period, and the sun was just coming up at the end of first period, and I was living in Maryland, so that effect would have been worse further north. So for large percentages of the U.S. population, what happened with year-round daylight savings time is sunrise was like 9:30 in the morning. So be careful what you wish for.
Jerry, thank you for that. And Dr. Villarreal, it speaks to the sunrise sunset issue. Go ahead.
Yes, so that is quite interesting. Also, another trivia fact is that the daylight savings was introduced by Germany, in 1916. During World War I, to help save some energy as they were getting ready for their war efforts, and then was adopted by many other countries in the U.S. in 1918.
Going back to sleep apnea for just a moment, with weight loss in your patients, can that resolve sleep apnea?
Yes, so weight loss can help obstructive sleep apnea quite significantly. And some people can even cure themselves and have this problem completely resolved. It all depends, on how bad they were to begin with and to see what other factors were involved. But I can tell you that tends to help a lot, especially with people who are quite overweight, whose sleep apnea is not very severe and who don't have any other factors on their airway, and this can improve things quite a bit. And there are also many other treatments that can help us besides weight loss, but weight loss is very helpful, although I must emphasize that it's easier said than done. And I know that a lot of people might have some struggles with this, but it tends to be, as I said, quite helpful.
Dr. Alexander Villarreal leads the Gunderson Sleep Center in La Crosse. Join in with questions and issues you encounter with rest and your sleep cycles, what you want to bring up, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into how sleep affects our body's systems as we prepare to turn clocks forward 1 hour or spring forward next weekend, losing an hour of sleep. We have sleep medicine physician Alexander Villarreal, who is here. Let's go to Dwayne in Wausau. Dwayne, hi.
Good morning, Kate and Dr. Sleep, I guess.
Good morning.
So, I have four things like to help me sleep. One is I keep a really boring book by my bed, one that puts you to sleep if you read it. And then dark chocolate, I know that can really disrupt your sleep for some people. And then caffeine is a double-edged sword where, you know, I work nights and people would drink coffee up until they go home. And then they wake up at 10 o'clock in the morning thinking it's going to be like 4 in the afternoon. And you can't get back to sleep once you see that sunlight and then too much sleep. When I was in tech school or college, I was getting too much sleep, and that made me more tired, you know. And so there's a few things. And one other thing was a sleep position. I read once where if you lay on your back, don't touch, like lay your arms at your side, not any part of your body touching another part. Is supposed to help. So those are a few things that help me.
Dwayne, thank you. Such interesting tips and observations. A personal there as well. Dr. Villarreal, what comes up for you?
Well, I think that's those are great tips that he had, but little trivia here about chocolate. So sure, does chocolate have some caffeine? Yes, it maybe does a little bit, but if I also invite here the listeners, I mean, go to your Google page or your favorite browser and search. Is it a caffeine comparison of different things? And a tablet of chocolate probably has about 10 milligrams of caffeine. And that is more or less the equivalent of what you would get in an 8-ounce cup of decaf coffee. So there's not much caffeine in chocolate. You really have to consume quite a bit to be affected by that. And then for reference, I said 8-ounce cup of distilled coffee has about 100 milligrams. 8-ounce cup of tea has about 50. You know, here, Mountain Dew, again, has roughly about 40 or 50, just like a cup of tea. And your Coke and Pepsi is 40. And if you go to your coffee shop, you might get things that are a lot stronger, depending on the size and how they were distilled.
Dwayne mentioned a boring book by their side. Do you have tips on how to fall asleep more easily?
So I would say I have two different types of recommendations. If normally you don't have any major problem sleeping, then just as I said, follow a healthy sleep routine. So you can read a little bit, is it do something relaxing. Make sure that you don't consume too much caffeine, is it in the afternoon or the evening or closer to your bedtime. Avoid the large amounts of alcohol, exercise, have a quiet, dark bedroom environment. All these things will be quite helpful. But if you already have a problem with chronic insomnia, so someone who has difficulty sleeping pretty much most nights or every night, someone who is struggling, is it, with this, following what's called, is it, sleep hygiene by itself might not be enough, because this is a great preventive measure, but most people with insomnia have already read everything about this. And if you follow these measures and sense that there's no improvement, it might just increase frustration. So a lot of people who have insomnia may need something more personalized. And the one thing that tends to work well for a lot of people with insomnia is something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which, as it adds extra techniques that'll help them achieve that sleep that they want.
What about a pharmaceutical approach? What medications might you typically prescribe for insomnia?
There are also, as it several pharmaceutical options, as it for insomnia, and this is currently like a second tier treatment. So we typically want to try non-pharmacological treatment first. It might be indicated in certain cases. So say if someone has an acute asthma attack and they're given high doses of prednisone, they might need like a short course of a sleep aid. Or some people who work night shift and they're not sleepy, but they have trouble sleeping throughout the day, sometimes might take a small dose of a hypnotic. And depending on the type of problem that they have, if it's a difficulty falling asleep initially, if it's staying asleep or both, and some other health problems and other medications they might take, then we have to choose carefully the type of sleep aid that we prescribe.
There is a new class of sleep medications, these orexin receptor antagonists, ORAs. Can you explain how this form of sleep medication might work on a patient?
Oh, yes, excellent. So this is a newer class of medications. They've been around, as I said, for the past maybe 6 to 8 years. And these two medications, as I said, that are present here in the U.S., we have suvorexant and lemorexant, act on orexin. And orexin is sort of like the switch that helps flip things from awake to sleep. But pretty much what they do is they make you into almost like a mini narcoleptic for, you know, 6 to 8 hours. And that's how they cause, is it, sleepiness. There's other medications that act on histamine. So you have like very low doxepin. They have some others that act on melatonin agonists. So we have like Remeltion there. We have others that act on GABA, which are like the, this is the most predominant, as it, type of sleeping aid. And we have two different types there. So we have a group that is called benzodiazepine that acts, as it, on the whole like GABA receptor. And then we have some of the older sleeping aids there, like temazepam, triazolam. And also we have some others that act on a very specific subunit of that GABA receptor. So there we have these zolpidem and esopiclone and zaleplon that are a little bit different. They have different properties and different durations, each of them. But yeah, that's definitely quite interesting.
What are your thoughts about over-the-counter sleep aids that people might reach for? What advice do you have there?
My advice would be just to be cautious, because everything is like a double-edged sword that can help, but also might have some side effects. Most of the most commonly found medications over the counter are either antihistaminics like diphenhydramine, also known as Benadryl, one of the most common things. So a lot of the PMs have a form of diphenhydramine or Benadryl. And although that can help some people sleep, it can also provide some dryness of the mouth. Some people can have constipation problems with their bladder, especially if they're elderly, and can cause some drowsiness in the morning because it tends to be a little bit longer acting. Mm. There is also melatonin that can be found over the counter. So we said this is a hormone. The major problem with melatonin is that it is not regulated as a medication in the U.S. It's regulated as a food supplement. So there was a study in 2016 that showed that 85% of melatonin found over the counter is not of good quality at all. And so therefore, we can't even recommend a particular brand of melatonin.
Talking about sleep. Oh, I'm sorry. I cut you off there. Go ahead.
Well, the other thing too about melatonin, as I was saying, is that it's quite tricky because it acts as it with your a biological system. Even if you got pharmaceutical grade melatonin, brought up from Europe, if you get a bright light in conjunction with melatonin, the effects of bright light are more powerful than those of melatonin. So some of those effects might be void.
Interesting. Dr. Alexander Villarreal, Medical Director of Gunderson Health System Sleep Center in La Crosse, as we talk about sleep issues, you can join in 800-642-1234. Steve in Oshkosh is here. Steve, hi.
Hi. I have started to just reset my clock every day so that it goes off at sunrise. Like this morning, sunrise is 6:23. Tomorrow it might be a couple minutes earlier. Would you say that's a good idea?
Yes, I said that can be a helpful idea. Said as long as you don't feel it's too burdensome for you. So, if you feel this is something that applies and works well with your lifestyle, that gradual adaptation can work quite well. Another thing too is that for those who are who enjoy everything that has to do with the math that goes with it, with the changing the body clock, or those who might take long trips and have time to make changes on this, there's a pretty cool app that was developed by the University of Michigan, and it is called Entrain, E-N-T-R-A-I-N. It's free, so again, I don't have any. But with that, as it say, if you can plot as it to what your current time is and what desired schedule you'd like to achieve over time. So, by entering those things, it can give you as it a plan on how to make those changes on your own.
Oh, thank you so much for that tip on Entrain. Steve, thanks for the call. Julie now in Sullivan. Julie, what is your question?
Well, yes, good morning. This is pretty interesting. My doctor and I had a discussion about my sleep issues, and I have dentures, complete dentures. So when I go get ready for bed, those are out and being cleaned, and then I go to bed without anything in my mouth, so that she thought that I should have a sleep study, which I will find the results tomorrow. She thought that maybe I had some obstruction due to the lack of space in the mouth and also the position of my tongue while I'm sleeping, because it would be different than someone that doesn't have, well, has their full dentures or their full mouth of teeth. So I wonder what you thought, if that was anything that's come up for you to talk about.
Julie, thank you.
Thank you, Julie. That's a very important topic for a lot of people, and especially those who might have obstructive sleep apnea. So the most prevalent therapy for that, besides weight loss, is CPAP, which is a machine that blows air and will wedge up open your throat using air pressure. It does this, as I said, through a small mask that can go either tightly around your nostrils, cover your nose, or nose and mouth. Now, the one thing is, when a person has dentures, that definitely changes, as I said, the shape of your face and the shape of your airway, and can limit also some types of treatments. For example, we couldn't do an adjustable oral appliance that is one of the therapies for sleep apnea. But in the setting of a CPAP, it is very important that if you ever require a mask, that you get fit for that mask the way you normally sleep. So if you sleep without your dentures, make sure those dentures are off, because otherwise they will fit you with the wrong size. It's like trying shoes with or without socks. It'll be a different experience. So you want to make sure they get things right for you. And it's probably the most important thing to look at. But I think it's a good idea that you're already thinking about this ahead of time.
Dr. Alexander Villarreal, sleep specialist at Gunderson Health System. Still time for your questions about sleep, how to work with your body's natural clock, bedtime rituals that help you awaken refreshed. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sleep specialist Dr. Alexander Villarreal is our guide to help us minimize seasonal sleepiness and explaining new research on how sleep patterns affect heart health and life expectancy, which we will talk about. Join in with your questions about sleep, 800-642-1234. Eden is here from West Salem. Eden, hi. Oh, I'm sorry, Edie.
Hi, yep, it's Edie.
Hi,
thanks for taking my call. I do suffer with the obstructive apnea, just recently diagnosed within the last year through Dr. Villarreal's program there in La Crosse. And I'm just curious about the new appliance that's out for Inspire versus the CPAP machine. It's some kind of implant. I'm wondering if he has any information about that use of, and if obstructive apnea can happen during the day versus when you're not sleeping.
Thank you, Edie. Those are excellent questions. And I'll start here with the last part of thought was that the reason we call it obstructive sleep apnea is because it only happens when you are asleep. When you're awake, I said the airway tone is normal, so you can breathe freely. There's no snoring, no gasping while you're awake. So that would apply, I said, whenever you're sleeping or napping. So day or night, as long as you're asleep, that's what changes things and relaxes your muscles. And as we mentioned, I said the main treatment for obstructive sleep apnea, especially for those with a more moderate to severe case, is a combination of weight management and CPAP. But there are many other things that we can do, I said, to treat obstructive sleep apnea. Some examples include various types of surgeries, including Inspire. I'll get to Inspire pretty soon. We have oral appliances made by dentists, positional therapy for some people. We have something called intraoral negative pressure. We have orofacial myofunctional therapy. These are exercises to strengthen the airway. If you want to try something a little bit different, playing the didgeridoo, expiratory positive airway pressure, elastic stockings if you have swelling in your legs, anaerobic exercise, tongue retaining devices, and even some medications. Now let's get back, I said, to what Inspire is, hypoglossal nerve stimulation. So this is a therapy that's been FDA approved, I said, since 2014. So a lot of experience there, it uses pacemaker technology. And it stimulates, I said, the hypoglossal nerve that helps, I said, move your tongue forward and lowers, I said, floor of the mouth down. This is, I said, a specialized type of surgery. So, and it is less effective than CPAP if we compare them side to side, but it's a pretty good alternative for certain types of people. So what are the steps to get into this? So the first is a person must have a sleep study that's recent, so no more than 2 years. Secondly, I said, we need proof that they were unable to tolerate CPAP despite their best efforts and despite multiple masks. Third, I said, this person, I said, must have at least moderate sleep apnea, so they have to have their airway closing for more than 10 seconds, no less than 15 times per hour, which is every 4 minutes. But it can't be beyond 65 times per hour. And they shouldn't have something called central sleep apnea that has to be ruled out. Additionally, I said, they can't be, I said, very overweight. Because I said, when someone is overweight, their airway is smaller, but especially becomes more narrow. So the cutoff for BMI, I said, is a BMI of 35 or less. Although a lot of insurances will go with 32. The original studies were done with a BMI less than 32. And after all that happens, I said, you get to, I said, have an exam of the airway where they look at your airway under some sedation or some anesthesia. And if things close from front to back, what we call anterior-posterior collapse, then you would benefit from this treatment. But if it closes like a little circle, what we call concentric collapse, then this would not be the best surgery for you. Go ahead.
I was just going to jump in there and thank her. Is there anything else that, before we move on, anything else you would like to say about this particular approach?
Yes, so it's complex. It's a long process. Just make sure you visit with a accredited sleep center that works with Inspire, and they can give you all those details, but it takes a lot of steps.
You mentioned Entrain app, and that brings up wearables, wearable technology like smartwatches that track sleep patterns, track heart rates simultaneously. Is this type of wearable technology reliable?
Well, I can tell you that technology is improving, and it's getting better and better. I can tell you that I've had quite a few patients who came to me telling me that their smart wearable device had showed them that their oxygen is dropping while they sleep. And after testing them, they indeed did have obstructive sleep apnea. Some of the different stages of sleep are also not as accurate, but they can give us an idea of when a person might be awake or asleep based on movement and heart rate variability. But the word of caution is some people really get obsessed and very obsessed about this and upset. And they have some scores that are somewhat arbitrary over 100%. And they tell you, well, you just got 60 or 70 points over 100. And they're upset they didn't get 100%. And to this we call orthosomnia. So just getting upset over the numbers that are not what you want them to be, but overall there's no major problem with your sleep.
Let's go to Catherine in Madison very quickly. Catherine, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to ask for if you've got sort of the latest information on sleep fragmentation and difficulty sleeping with advancing age. Is that inevitable? Are there any sort of remedies or approaches for managing that?
Catherine, thank you. I'm going to toss it back to you, Dr. Villarreal, as we're short on time.
Correct. So there are normal changes with sleep and age, just a graying of the hair. So one is that we get much less deep sleep. There is more middle of the night awakenings. There's an increased risk of napping. There's a little bit more superficial sleep. If these problems are an issue for you, please make sure you find out here with your local sleep doc or someone who applies cognitive behavior therapy, as they can help improve your overall sleep quality.
Do older adults just need less sleep?
The overall amount of sleep doesn't change too much after our 20s. Teens definitely need more sleep than adults, but as we get older, we still need roughly about the same amount of sleep. It's just chopped up a little bit more, and there's a slightly higher need of napping.
Dr. Villarreal, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you to the audience.
Dr. Alexander Villarreal is medical director of the La Crosse-based Sleep Center at Gundersen Health System. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.